Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to the 100th episode of Beyond the Screenplay.
Yeah.
The podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today we are talking about the 2007 film No Country for Old Men. Again, I'll get into that in a second. Written and directed, of course, by the Coen brothers, based on the novel by Cormac McCarthy. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, friendo.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
So here we are, 100 episodes later. It's kind of insane. That's a lot. And so the reason that we are talking about No Country is that way back when, over 2 years ago, apparently, when we were... So basically, this is like the inception of the podcast story. Mm-hmm. It was like hanging out, all of us as a team, talking about movies, and someone had the idea of like, this could be a good like podcast maybe, but wanted to try it out and do a first go at it. So we all met up in my living room, sat around a table and talked about No Country for Old Men. It was rough, but fun. Afterward, realized that the good audio with the good microphones was not recording. So we only had a backup that was recorded on my iPhone. So we released that to patrons. So that exists, that very first conversation.
You can listen to it. I don't know if anyone ever has, but it's out there.
But we haven't. And we thought it would be fun for 100 episodes to go back to the very beginning and do a new episode about No Country for Old Men. So none of us have listened to that original episode. I really don't know what that conversation was like, but we're going to have a new conversation about one of the greatest films of all time, which I'm very excited about. Trisha, it's obviously a big favorite of yours. You have a very big grin on your face. So yeah, so this is going to be really fun. Before we jump in, just want to say thank you to you, listener, right now that is listening to this, for making this show possible. If you're a patron, thank you for helping us grow the show and push it to be something more substantial. And you guys, the team, Trisha, Alex, Brian, thank you guys. You know, like when we were talking about starting a podcast, I was kind of nervous because it's like a more vulnerable thing, like putting yourself out there and like the videos of Less Than Trump Screenplay, I can just kind of be a disembodied voice and like my personality doesn't have to be out there. And so doing something like this was scary, but I'm just very grateful that we have the camaraderie that we do and that everyone was patient and willing to make it something special. And I'm really proud of what we've done. So thank you guys so much for going on this journey.
Well, thank you for being our helmsman at the helm of the ship. Metaphors, like none of us.
The captain, the word you're looking for.
None of us good at word speak, but thank you for taking us on this journey with you.
I feel like he's our Captain Picard. He's our Patrick Stewart kind of captain of a starship.
The kindest thing anyone's ever said.
I was just going to say, we have 100 episodes of evidence that Michael is not actually a robot.
Maybe like 80 episodes.
The evidence trends toward not robot, at least.
Yeah.
Yes. And thank you, of course, to our producer, Vince, who is always here listening behind the scenes.
We love you, Vince.
He's yet to appear on a show, but one day. And of course, our editor, Eric Schneider, who makes us sound smarter.
Oh, my God.
And better. More well-spoken than we are. Okay.
Yeah, good luck with that thing I said about the ship, though, Eric.
If anybody can do it, Eric can.
Yeah. So, No Country for Old Men. So the reason we chose it way back when is that we just done a Less Than Trump Screenplay video about it. And since then, it's become one of the most popular videos. I think it's easily in the top 10. It has 2 million views. And so it was really... That was one of the first like collaboration videos also, like we did in team, and Brian, that you like spearheaded, and it was sort of like that whole thing. So there's a lot to talk about there from the video. But also since then, we've learned, Trisha, that it was on your top 10 of everything for all time, number one or something, right? Tell us about how you feel about No Country for Old Men, Trisha.
Are there enough superlatives? It is definitely one of my favorite movies of all time. I'm going to go its top three. Like, for sure. It's probably, like, Jurassic Park and Casablanca and this. And, like, depending on the day, I might, you know, pick different ones to be the leader there. The Coen brothers are my favorite filmmakers. And I consider this to be absolutely their masterpiece. I think every frame of it is perfect. It is a very rare example of a movie where every single moment and shot and every cut in it, every like beat of every performance, I think is just all so tightly woven together and so completely and coherently expresses this rich and fascinating theme. And like no corner of it is wasted. No fragment of it does not complete like that puzzle. And the picture that the puzzle makes is so meaningful and like speaks into the deep sort of philosophy of life and just kind of hits me at my core of like questions that I have about like life and the universe and
everything.
Yes. Thank you, Brian.
Anytime.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I grapple with a lot of the same questions about, you know, God and the universe that the Coen brothers do and justice and all of these kinds of things that this movie is about. And the Coen brothers, you know, deal with these themes across their filmography, but in No Country, I feel like they've fully expressed a very bleak but beautifully expressed conclusion sort of about some of these questions and about these themes. And so I just cannot get over any part of this movie. And I promise I will try not to monopolize this podcast with just all everything that I want to praise about it. But I think it's phenomenal. So let's go.
Okay, great. So Brian, you wrote the video way back when. What are your thoughts on No Country? Have they changed since, you know, the last time you watched it? Any new feelings watching it more recently?
Well, to set the record straight, Trisha always says she's so jealous that I got to write the video. And I will clarify that I did not write this video. I pitched it and wrote a first draft, which had a Men in Black 3 joke and a Childish Gambino reference.
Yes.
And then Michael said, thanks, welcome to the team, I'll be back. And then he made the video that got 2 million views. So I think I put the curtain thing, like the fact that he puts one curtain over the other, and then when he comes back, he sees they're parted. Something around there was my contribution to the video.
It's a critical part of the video.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole 2+2 concept. And the cool thing is watching the movie this time for my, I don't know, eighth time, I saw even more 2+2, even more things where I'm like, oh right, that's how that was, or that's what he was thinking there. That's what he was doing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't think my thoughts on this movie have changed much at all in 14 years. And that's a good thing. It was on my top 10 of the aughts, and it was such a frustrating, but in a way where I knew it was supposed to be experienced the first time watching it. And all I wanted to do was go read Ed's monologue and try to get a sense of like, what is this movie actually trying to say? Why did it do the things it did? And of course, then I had to watch it again. And yeah, every time I watch it, I get new things out of it, but I feel like I have the same experience every time. And I mean that in the most positive way, which is just I'm entertained. I'm giggling. I'm frustrated. I'm depressed. It's just like, and then you have the little glimmer of hope in the final, like, I don't know, 30 seconds of the movie, maybe, where you're like, oh, maybe there's like this spark of a thought of a wick of a candle at the end of this dark, very dark tunnel that is, you know, there's a fire up ahead.
Nope. Then I woke up.
And then I woke up. Yeah. So yeah, I love this movie. And no, I would not say my thoughts have changed much on it, but they have just always been positive and they continue to be.
Mm. Awesome. Yeah. I feel the same way. So I'll just say that. That's my report. Alex, what are your thoughts?
I had a whole journey with this movie because it was the year that There Will Be Blood came out, right? This was the weird competition in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Not be a competition.
Yeah, it's like it there's no actually sense at all. They're quite different movies, but I think for some reason people categorize them as like the same type of movie, I guess, you know, kind of a tour Western, somewhat disconcerting,
bleak
Oscar movies.
Shot in Marfa, Texas. I mean, the landscapes do look basically exactly the same because they were shot within a few miles of each other.
Right. It's not unreasonable to compare these movies.
Yes.
Right.
But
because of that, I was kind of buying into that mindset where when it was Oscar time, I was on team There Will Be Blood because that is peak post-film school Alex. That is all about, you know, PTA, all about, you know, that really cool Johnny Greenwood score, all about the kind of the bigness of that movie. I was a little bit frustrated with what I now think is the most amazing thing about this movie, which is it's just efficient, sparse perfection. I think it's amazingly perfect now. But at the time when I first saw it, I was kind of frustrated. I'm like, I do want more score. I do want more to this movie. I want the ending to make sense. I don't know what's happening anymore in this last act. Like, where am I? What's going on? I only saw the movie once in theaters, and I was making that weird, unfair comparison to There'll Be Blood. And I just kind of decided There'll Be Blood won in my mind. And so I didn't like No Country for Old Men as much. But man, watching it again, every time I revisit it, I love it more and more and more. And what you said, Trisha, seems so accurate to me, which is, especially upon repeat viewings, this movie reveals itself to just be insanely, weirdly perfect. As far as just like on a technical level, even just like you said, this edit always feels right. This shot feels right. This sound design feels right. This performance feels right. This casting feels right. Like, it's one of those things where, you know, we've talked a lot in the past about, you know, when a movie bumps for us, or when, you know, something comes up in a film where it kind of knocks you out of its world, or it suddenly breaks the illusion of like this great story you're wrapped up in, because there is a performance that's kind of off, or a visual effect that looks bad, or whatever. This movie doesn't have any of those moments. There's no moment where I bump. Mm-hmm. There are moments where I am, like Brian said, kind of frustrated or getting confused, or I'm challenged by this movie, but none of that feels like it was a bump, where it was like a mistake or something that could have been done better. Everything feels like exactly what the Coen brothers intended. It almost is impossible to make a movie, period, and to get all the way through the entire process and have every moment fulfill what seems like your intent does feel like a minor miracle. So yeah, watching this movie again just this week, it was like a reminder of like, wow, yeah, this doesn't happen very often, where a movie survives the entire process this intact and this full of purpose and perfection. So what an achievement. And it is among my favorite movies, I think. The more I watch it, the more it like moves up the list.
I mean, look, sometimes your snap judgments aren't the best. When there were two shows coming out about behind the scenes of a comedy show, I was like, oh, which one's going to succeed? The Aaron Sorkin one or the Tina Fey one? And I was wrong. And after eventually watching 30 Rock, I was so happy to be wrong, because I don't want 7 seasons of Studio 60.
Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. Although some of it was great.
Oh, sure. But if I had to choose which one of those shows would go on for 7 seasons, 30 Rock.
And to be clear, people that are on Team There Will Be Blood are also welcome at this table. Like,
absolutely.
It did weirdly pit us against each other, and we don't need to be. And No Country welcomes you. There is plenty of nihilism to go around.
Yes.
There is no reason for you to feel alienated by this film. You also can just wallow in the bleakness of the American West.
Yeah.
It's here for you.
Take your poison.
Yeah.
Although I did come into this with a frustration of PTA and a love for the Coen brothers. So it was like no question for me which of these movies I was going to care about more.
Oh, hard same. But still, it's, We'll get to that movie at some other time.
Right. Yeah. It's weird that we still haven't talked about it, because I was hardcore on There Will Be Blood side also. At least, Alex, you saw No Country for Old Men before deciding which was better. I was just like, oh, wow. Coen, like, no, There Will Be Blood is the best thing ever. My God. So I've had quite an arc where, yes,
even more of an arc.
Yeah.
All right, Trish and I are going to meet on one side of the airport, and Michael and Alex will meet on the other side, and we'll just run at each other and fly and see what happens.
Right. Civil War. I will say, watching it this time, after watching it, I don't know how many times, you know, during the process of making a video, you kind of like wear the movie out a little bit. I still loved it and enjoy it, and it all worked for me. The only thing that changed was there were moments where I could kind of see the seams a little bit, where it's like, this is still a gown, is the metaphor I'm going to use. This is still like a piece of clothing that is perfect, but if you look closely, you can tell that it was made by a human, where they're just like a little bit, but that kind of adds
that
to
is
the
Michael's
perfection.
Critique of this movie. You can tell it was made by a human being.
I highly suspect humans were involved in making this film, and that should not be how films are made.
robot.
Yeah. Anyway, which ultimately I think just makes me appreciate it more because it takes it down from that level of, you know, godly perfection and just like this was made by people doing really, really good work. And like it is essentially perfect, even if like, you know, you can see like a tiny crease here or there.
I want to hear about these seams and what stood out to you this time that didn't stand out before.
They're super minor to the point where I don't think I can even point to that many. I feel like there are like occasionally like line readings that feel like, oh, maybe that was like
by zero. By whom?
Just like, again, this is like the most nitpicky of nitpicky where it's like,
okay,
0.1%. Maybe that was a little too funny for this moment. Like maybe it was just off just a hair or like there are CGI animals and they're very brief, but they do like
there are
make
CGI
me go,
animals.
Oh, look at that CGI animal. So just like the tiny little things, the tiniest possible little nitpicks are. Is all I'm saying.
I will say virtually every line reading by Tommy Lee Jones is really funny. Like there are, except for the ones like at the very end where there's just nothing but like tragedy and emptiness in his life at the end. But up until that point, nearly every line reading is pretty much a little bit funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's cordial of him.
Right. You know, looking for a man who has recently drunk milk. Like that, you know, it's just like, it is supposed to be sarcastic, right? That's a characterization thing that he is doing with Sheriff Ed Tom Bell. But it does often call attention to him and to itself. And I think this movie needs that note of comedy. Like, not that there are not funny moments with all the characters. Like, I think that's one of the most brilliant things about this is that even when your heart is in your throat and you are so convinced that Sugar is going to kill whoever he's talking to, you're also a little bit laughing because the character doesn't know what's coming, but you do, right? This movie is so intimate that, you know, you're inside every moment of it in a way that none of the individual characters are.
Mm.
So, like, thinking about, you know, the sort of pivotal scene where Sugar is challenging that man at the gas station, right? Where he kind of like chokes on his peanuts and he's like, you married into it? Mm-hmm. And he's like,
does a spit take basically?
Yeah, he basically does. And it's big, right? It's like, it's kind of a big-ish, as big as this movie gets, which is very, very downbeat, but and very droll. But still, it's a little bit of like, you know, and we understand that this man is playing with his life, right? Or like this scene is going to end with his death probably, or at least there's a decent chance of that. But yet we're inside of Sugar's head. We're also inside of like the subtext immersed in it. So there's humor to be found in all of that. There's a base layer of humor, which is really remarkable that this movie is able to pull that off.
Yeah, I think it's something we talked about with Lord of the Rings, which is it does a lot to have characters who themselves have a sense of humor.
Right.
So, but not only does Ed, so does Llewellyn, and so does Chigurh to a certain extent. Yeah. There are times where he is finding the comedy in a certain moment, or he is the one who, for as much as we think of his performance as being so this one bleak tone, he does kind of show little shades of kind of, for lack of a better word, humanity there. And then in case you were worried about your movie getting too bleak, here's Stephen Root and Woody Harrelson to liven things up.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, watching the behind the scenes, apparently in the book, which I have not read, but apparently in the book, Chigurh is described kind of simply as he has no sense of humor. And that's kind of all the description that happens. And so Javier Bardem and the Coens had to kind of build out a character that felt true to the essence of that, but still felt believable. And like he could take up space on screen and not just be like dour or, you know, kind of two-dimensionally robot killer person. And I feel like that the comedy does, like giving him a little bit of, you know, I don't think someone could tell him a joke and he would laugh, but like finding the irony in situations like amusing does kind of give him that extra dimension.
Yeah. And I love that they gave that line to Carson Wells where he's talking to, you know, Moss about it. And he's like, well, how would you describe him? He's like, well, I would say he doesn't have a sense of humor, you know? And then at that point, that line itself almost becomes a joke because of everything we've seen from Sugar up until that point, that saying he doesn't have a sense of humor is true, but also an understatement.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting is that it is true, because Shiger, like, he can't be talked down from something. He's not going to be disarmed through humor, like, directed at him. There's such pleasure that comes from watching his interactions with these ordinary people, because he is basically an alien. Like, he's an alien who's come to planet Earth and is remarking on the weirdness of, like, everyday just conversation or the things we say to each other. And it's always, I find it extremely pleasurable in a film to get to watch the way that we conduct ourselves in society be called into question. And the way he does it is very intimidating. You know, you've got this environment, this time and place where people are very polite and kind of assume the best about strangers. And he just totally screws with that left and right. And it's both tense, because you can feel the social tension on top of the mortal tension of the scene. And it just adds to that, like, that kind of uncomfortable humor left and right, which is just, it's just so great.
Yes.
I like that the humor, I feel like it's part of even the thematic conversation, because I guess it's like,
right,
the whole thing is like about life. And so there's a lot that can be encapsulated in that. But that Sheriff Ed Tom even has that line of like, I laugh myself sometimes. Ain't a whole lot else you can do, right? Like, that's kind of in the text also, of like, sometimes the absurdity of, and just like the reckless, meaningless violence of existence is so incomprehensible, all you can do is laugh. And so I like that this movie is funny while also talking about all those things.
Which is a hallmark of Coen Brothers movies, right? Like, they are so interested in, like, the bleakness and the violence and the sort of chaos of existence. And yet all they're kind of left with is humor. I mean, I'm not going to get too much into it, but their movie right after this one was Burn After Reading, which is one of their comedies. But of course, if you've seen it, definitely has some very violent and shocking and sort of horrifying moments. And certainly trades on a lot of the same themes that they're exploring in No Country. And No Country, I feel like, is a really balanced sort of nihilism, which is like, if all of life is meaningless and there is no justice, then it's funny sometimes and tragic at others, but here we all are. It's sort of like a very straightforward, like, frank look at all of that. Whereas I feel like some of their other comedies get more into, like, we're going to make fun of people who think that this is tragic, or like they sort of move more towards like aggressive comedy about sort of the chaos and tragedy of existence. I love them.
Well, it's something we talked about on the Big Lebowski podcast, where I talked about the sort of what I call implied magic that the Coen brothers like to do, which is some movies like Barton Fink or Hudsucker Proxy, it's just like, oh no, we'd literally I have real magic happening here. Like, time just stopped or whatever. And then you have the more nuanced, like the stranger in Big Lebowski, who just sort of shows up and he's talking to the camera. So like, there's a camera in his universe that we are on the other side of. And for this being the Coen brothers' most down to earth movie, maybe True Grit is a little closer, but for being a movie that is not trying to be sort of wacky in that Coen brothers way, you do have this character of Anton Chigurh, who himself is an idea. He's not even meant to be a human. Ethan Coen says of the character in the book, he says quite clearly in the book, he's a personification of the world, which is an unforgiving and capricious place. The embodiment of that is the whole coin tossing thing that gives the character place, and it doesn't have to do with good and evil. So just this sort of like this life and death and consequence or just random chance, it's all inevitable, it is all going to happen. So then that is who this character of Anton Chigurh is. It's like, it doesn't even matter whether we think he is a real human being with an origin story, or if he is just like literally death, or, you know, some sort of manifestation of an idea that somehow exists that we can see in flesh, because that's not the point of what the movie is doing. And I want to read from the Carla Jean scene with him in the book. I'll do that later. But it's interesting that Chigurh knows that that's what he is. So it's sort of, you know, when Carla Jean says like, oh no, it's just you. There's no, and he's like, no, this is the way it is. So it's almost like you kind of get the sense that I'm glad the movie never says, you know, this character is a god or something, but you kind of get the sense that both the filmmakers and the character himself know that that is who he is playing in this world.
I got here the same way the coin did.
Right.
I was thinking about it, and it reminded me of, I mentioned for my What Am I Watching recently, Malcolm Gladwell did this three-part series on The Little Mermaid, and kind of the history of fairy tales was part of that, and how fairy tales back in the day weren't stories where the bad guys get punished and the good guys always win. Like, the lessons they were imparting were more about, like, just the unpredictability and unfairness of life, actually. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the kind of dumb sister that, like, doesn't know what she's doing, goes out to get milk, and then ends up stumbling upon a necklace, and now she's the queen. Like unfair, random stuff like that.
Right.
And this movie, like, is maybe one of the only examples we have of that, like, in a modern kind of context of, like, it does feel like a fairy tale, like, for all the reasons you're saying, Brian, like, he's the personification of a thing. He's not, like, a person where you need to know the backstory and all this stuff. And then the ending is, of course, not a tale of, like, good guys win and bad guys lose and there is justice and there is, like, it subverts all of that. And it's so disturbing to us as a modern audience, because we're like, well, that's not how stories are supposed to work. That's maybe how reality works,
right?
But that's not how stories are supposed to work. And I just love that. That like, this movie just breaks that wide open and makes you sit with that uncomfortable.
Well, it's a really fine line to walk, because if you have stories where the events are fundamentally unrelated and they're not tied together by anything, then they're simply not stories. They're not followable. We lose patience for them. We don't want them, right? So events need to be caused, right? Like, we talk about how in film, you know, in an ideal world, you have like becauses between scenes where it's like, because this and then this like was caused by that. And there's like a chain of causality. And if we don't have that, then we start to get really frustrated where it's like, why am I watching this scene? It's not caused by anything. It came out of nowhere. I think one of the ways that the Coen brothers achieve this is because they introduce randomness really early on in this movie, where we are sort of trained to expect it by the movie a little bit. You know, all good movies sort of teach you how to watch them. And right. This movie teaches you how to watch it from pretty early on. And I think one of the biggest factors in this is the Mexican drug cartel and the sort of like cast of whoever those guys are. We're never shown who they are. They're just sort of this like faceless entity of people that are there to interfere because they also want to get the money. But we're never going to see any of them up close, really. There's like one moment where one of those guys walks up to Carla Jean's mom at the bus station and talks to her for a minute and gets some information from her. But other than that, we don't meet any of them ever. We have no idea who they are. And they effectively serve as interlopers. Really quickly, I did like a full 20-minute thematic analysis about No Country for Old Men in a video that I wrote for Wisecrack. So if you're interested in the history of Westerns, from classic Westerns to revisionist Westerns to neo-Westerns and film noir and their influences on No Country for Old Men thematically, you can check that video out. It's long. I won't get into it.
We'll put a link in the description.
Yes. But one of the things I got to get into in that video a little bit was what interlopers are in literature. And I don't feel like they're talked about enough, because they're not often employed by writers. But interlopers in literature are like agents of chaos, essentially, who are there to swoop in and purposefully confound like schemes and plans that characters make. As we know in storytelling, characters need to make plans. It helps the audience understand where the movie's going next. And interlopers are there not to be like central antagonists or to have clear motivations. We never need to know what their motivations are. They're just there to confound plans, essentially. And so the Mexican drug cartel, they serve as interlopers, and they turn out to be critical interlopers by the film's end, obviously, because they're the ones that take out Moss off screen three quarters of the way through the movie's runtime.
Disconcerting.
That term, by the way, popularized by the author Saki, who wrote a story called The Interlopers, which I believe was from the early 1900s that you can read. But basically that story is about like characters that are in the woods, and there's like a long family feud, and it's like sort of a character study on like, will they ever forgive each other? And then the end of that story is they both get eaten by wolves. So,
well, on the topic of Trisha things, let's just talk about theme for a minute, because I do think this movie is so imbued just in the text itself, in the dialogue. There are thematic discussions happening, and the whole, like, the final act or whatever you would call it of this movie is essentially just like talking about theme. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing else happening anymore, which is like, it makes sense why this is like your top three. Yeah, because it's an interesting thematic journey this movie takes me on, because it's not just like super simple. It's doing a few things. There's the usual Coen Brothers randomness and unfairness of life and reality in the universe. And then there's this generational thing. Mm-hmm. There's this time and place thing going on, like, in addition to the larger, just the universe is kind of random and a big joke. And so, yeah, I guess, Trisha, take it away. Like, talk about how you read those two things kind of being put together in this novel, in this movie. You know, why this time, why this place, why this character that Tommy Lee Jones plays? How does that connect to the Coen Brothers thing? Like, why is this the movie that nailed it finally, you know, in this time and place?
To address this like sort of as simply as possible, I think the answer really does lie in genre. Mm. And that's why I spent so much time in the Wisecrack video you can watch talking about the history of Westerns as a genre. But Westerns, particularly as a genre, are concerned with ideas of justice, right? What is justice? Where does it come from? You know, in the simplest terms, in classic Westerns, justice is like good guys versus bad guys. People are only good or only bad. And the good guys administer justice onto the bad guys. And Tommy Lee Jones's character, Ed Tombell, in this movie is literally like a white hat wearing sheriff that comes from like a long line of sheriffs and lawmen. And he tells you that in his 90-second opening monologue. It's a full minute and a half of like, let me just tell you, which is fascinating because we don't meet him after that for like quite a while.
For a long time. Just the note that I wrote was like, opening monologue is disgustingly good. Was the first
thing. Yeah, it is.
And it's all theme. Like, yeah. Right. Is the other thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Open a movie with monologues about theme. Close the movie with monologues about theme. But anyway, so there's, you know, sort of classical Western sort of ideas about justice. Revisionist Westerns are more about like morally gray worlds that are like navigated by people like Llewellyn. So you have like, basically Sheriff Bell is straight out of a classic Western. Llewellyn is sort of straight out of like a revisionist Western sort of from the 60s. Mm. It's like, there's money. I'm trying to do the moral thing. Like, he goes back and takes that guy some water, which is a really interesting moment in the movie like he steals the money and then goes all the way back out there.
I love the way it's shot also, and it has that like, you know, they reuse that shot later of like, this is the shot that we use when Moss is like, can't sleep and is about to make up his mind about something. It's just like, it like cranes down at this weird speed. Also, like, there's just something about the way it's shot that just feels like other in such a great way. And I just like, we have to talk about Deacon still, but yes, continue. Yes.
Anytime I have like a moral nagging about something that I can't get away from, I always say like, I'm fixing to do something dumber than hell, but I'm going to go do it anyway. That's, I love it. But then the neo-Western, you know, or film noir, which neo-Westerns often blend genres, and particularly from noir, which Coen brothers love to do because they love noir movies, are sort of about, like the sort of moral-less, justice-less chaos of like sort of modern life. And so if you can think of Ed Tombell being straight out of a classic Western and Llewellyn being straight out of a revisionist Western, you can think of Chigurh as being straight out of like noir or a neo-Western as like an embodiment of there is no justice to speak of. So I think that when you like sort of close that loop where, you know, the whole time we're maybe expecting like some kind of revisionist Western style karma to get
right
to Chigurh by the end.
Right.
Because that's kind of what revisionist Westerns are about. They're like, there is justice. It maybe doesn't come from the lawmen, but it comes from the universe. And like
the car crash, like that's supposed to be where he gets his comeuppance. Yeah,
exactly. Like, people who live by violence die by violence. So it's going to happen to him. It'll happen eventually. Like, that's kind of that sort of moral code. And then when Llewellyn doesn't get him, you still are expecting maybe there'll be a confrontation with Sheriff Bell and Bell will find him eventually. And then Belle just kind of like gives up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In the face of like, I don't know what to do about this. I feel overmatched.
Yeah, so much there. Yeah, I brought up the idea of the filmmaker gods, which I'll wait till my lesson to really talk about. But it's sort of that, like, the car crash is supposed to be the deus ex machina, but then they're very purposely going like, no, sorry, you don't get that, you know? And and if you look at the characters of Belle and Llewellyn, they are both, as you were saying, Tricia, like, they are telling you about this theme, where Belle's opening monologue is, you know, I don't want to see something I don't understand. So I want to hear about the old ways where you didn't have to carry a gun and things like he's very scared of the future, his own mortality. He's like, I don't want any part of it. And then you have Moss. There's this echoed line between Moss and then Ellis, the guy who Belle talks to at the end, where Llewellyn is talking to the woman at the pool. And, you know, she says, oh, is your wife, is that who you're looking for? He says, yeah, half the time. She says, well, what about the rest of the time? He says, just looking for what's coming. And she says, yeah, but you can't see that.
Yeah, nobody ever sees that.
Nobody ever sees that. And then Ellis says, you know, in his lovely little speech to Belle, he says, you can't stop what's coming. That's vanity, you know. And that's sort of the interesting thing is Moss seems to be at least a little more accepting of the world as it is, because he is, you know, younger. But Belle is very clearly just sort of terrified of it. And the look on Tommy Lee Jones' face when he gives that last monologue, he looks like a child who is scared, you know, and for someone who is sort of so flippant and everything during this movie, he just is so, like, he's so vulnerable in that moment, and I love it. But yeah, and then of course Shigert plays this force, this thing that they are talking about, this inevitability, you know, that is coming for them, and he can't be stopped. But he, you know, the only reason, as you were saying, Tricia, the only reason Belle survives is because he worries about himself more than anything else. Like, he's sort of, you might call him a coward, but he also is just like, I want to live longer. So I'm going to not put myself in danger's way and hope that I can live longer as a result.
Well, actually, I would like to get your thoughts, because I read it differently every time I watch it, because Belle doesn't give up before he actually does go back and try one last time at the hotel room where Moss died. And I've watched it 1,000 times, because they show us a shot of Shigur in the room.
Right.
What do we make of this?
What do we make of it? Like, I don't know what is being communicated. Like, I have this idea in my brain that maybe Shigur is in the room next door.
Yeah, I was wondering that.
No, but there's like,
he's looking
at the open keyhole. Yeah. Like, it's like a shot, reverse shot. Really clearly. Yeah.
So I'm scrubbing through because I want to verify this.
I rewatched this scene because I was like freaking out last
night. I've watched it so many times.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's really fascinating. This time I caught, and I'm scrubbing through because I want to make sure that this is the case, but I'm pretty sure that one of the final shots in that scene is you see a dime on the floor, like heads up. And so to me, that just made me read it as like the coin toss went Ed Tom's way this time.
But he didn't call it.
But he didn't call it.
And he also uses the coin to open up the air duct in the other room. So it's like, that's also a thing that has been established. Like,
yeah,
like
we see the air duct on the ground, and then it's the coin. And actually, that is, although you do raise a really good point, Michael, in terms of emphasis that the filmmaking places on that image, because that is the image that we use to then fade. And like, we focus, the coin is like the last thing that fades out.
Right. The very last shot of that scene.
Yeah. Before we cut to Belle's truck driving out to where he goes to meet Ellis. So it does sort of imply that like the coin toss just went his way. Like, or yeah, there was a 50-50 chance. I don't know. I always kind of read it as like there was a 50-50 chance he'd walk into the room where Shigur was. And then he didn't end up like picking that room. But
it's the one part of the movie where it's like, yeah, everything else in this film is so intentional and so perfect. This must be intentional, but like, what? Like, what is it?
Well, like, in the scene right before that, Tommy Lee Jones's character, Belle says, like, sometimes I think he's pretty much a ghost. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if they're like trying to literally be like, he's a ghost, or they're messing with the time frame of it, where because also Belle notices the window is open, like he goes into the room. The lock is shot out. The window's open or unlocked. Yeah.
Yeah, unlocked. It's closed and there's a shot. I can't tell if it's locked or not, but there's a shot of the lock.
It's unlocked, yeah.
At least like a very big close-up.
The lock is unlocked. The window open is later with Carla Jean when she walks into her own house after the funeral.
Right.
She sees that
right.
The window open.
I think that shot of the lock, my brain doesn't register if that means it's locked or it's unlocked. It's like not 100% clear. But yeah, that is the one scene of the movie that, yeah, maybe I do still bump on just because it's like, feels impossible to decode in a way that the rest of the movie is decodable. And that part is like just the one most elusive moment of, but maybe it's intentional and it's because it's everything is clearly intentional.
I just read the scene from the script and it's not helpful at all.
Okay. I was looking for that also. I feel like that plugs in intentionally, and maybe that's kind of like the cheat code of this movie in some ways, but like that we can't make sense of why he survived or not, like because there maybe is no sense to be made or to be found in any
which is the whole point,
right? It's almost like that whole entire last act is just kind of like we're through the looking glass, like don't try to make sense of this world. Like you are in Tommy Lee Jones's head now, like you are Officer Bell and you don't understand what's what and why anything is happening. And that is, I think that is a valid reason to construct that scene that way, to just make us feel as disoriented as he does. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I also love that scene visually, like the cinematography is, I mean, again, the whole movie,
it's stupidly good,
but I feel like that's where it goes like super noir. Like I think what I love also about, like, this might be my favorite Deakins movie. I don't know, like Blade Runner is beautiful, but like something about this is just,
it's perfect.
It's
perfect,
and like lit by like the dual headlights of the car, like it creates such a mood that it's just really, really great. I also want to talk about, we're talking about this one scene that's very hard to decode, but there's so many scenes in this script that are so hyper efficiently good at setting up a character or a relationship. Like the scene that where you meet Sheriff Ed Tom and his wife, like they exchange a couple lines, but just the staging, what they're doing, like their performances, you get the whole history of them like immediately. Same thing with Moss and Carla Jean, like when he comes back home and he's in the trailer. Like it's just so disgustingly good. It's written so concisely. It's so effective. And the performances, like the subtext that comes across with so little. The one that stood out to me is when Moss is tracking down the briefcase of money for the first time and he opens it and is going through the money and just says, he just says the word but you can tell there's so much in that like
when he decides to go back
exactly. That's a big signal for me of like a great performance, and a great performance in sync with the script and the story is like broadcasting the subtext super loudly through quiet tiny lines. Like that is takes a lot of skill and is super impressive.
I'll just say this movie more than any other modern film just feels like a great example of pure cinema. Like what is this art form good for, and like what can you do with the tools of this art form? Like this is just the purest expression of audio visual storytelling, and it's so efficient and just does it, and no frills. It's just doing it in the most efficient, clean, brilliant way possible.
Well, what you were saying, Michael, reminds me of a little note that one of my screenwriting professors used to write on our scripts, which was LTTA. And what it stood for was let the actors act. And I don't think she abbreviated that right. But
yeah, I was going to say
words.
The T for actors.
Her point was fewer words in your dialogue and also in your like direction in the script. And if you're the Coens, you can do this because you're working extensively with the best actors that there ever have been. But fewer words in the dialogue is a really good word here. And this movie is an incredible example of underwritten subtext loaded dialogue where you've pointed to some of like the most laconic examples, right, where they're just like Llewellyn is saying virtually nothing and yet he's like conveying volumes, but Ed Tom Bell is like this too, and Ed Tom Bell is one of the talkiest characters and yet he still feels very underwritten. Mm-hmm. Right, but like Chigurh is like very, very underwritten and everything. Carson Wells talks a lot and in the like three scenes that he's in. But yeah, it all conveys like volumes. I love Woody Harrelson's sigh when he's trying to, you know, convey to Moss that like he's gonna get killed, right? He's like, well, he's not gonna find me again any which way or something. And Wells goes, no, you don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just because, again, subtext exists when we, the audience, are present and we understand things the characters don't have a full understanding of, right? Moss does not have a full understanding. Like,
right.
He thinks he does. So we're on Wells's side, right? Like, how do we as Wells convey to Moss that he doesn't understand? Obviously, more words are not going to change that fact. And just letting the actor say what we feel, right? Like with four words, essentially.
Yeah, I know I've recommended Blood Simple before, the Coen Brothers' yes. first film, but I need to say, like, if you are a fan of No Country, you have to watch Blood Simple. It is No Country practice. Like, it opens with shots of Texas while Emmett Walsh delivers a monologue about the theme in voiceover, and then he is the assassin coming for Frances McDormand. There is a sequence of about 20 minutes where there is almost no dialogue the entire time, and you are putting together everything in your head, and it is so captivating and so compelling. It just, watching that movie after watching No Country made me completely reappreciate it, because I was like, oh my gosh, I get another one of these. Like, there's actually another one of these out there. But then, to what you were saying, Trisha, about what filmmaking can do, I was reading the Carla Jean scene from the book, and it's so interesting because Cormac McCarthy, he writes in this, there's no quotes or anything. There's just sort of like sentence, and it goes through. And in the movie, what we get, the Coens joked that what they did was basically just, they're like, it took two of us to write this movie because one of us could hold the book open and the other one could type. They're just like, that's how true they were to the source material and how exactly. much they just wanted to. But the one big change they made, or one of the big changes they made, is the way that they present the Carla Jean sequence. So what we get is something you can do in film really well, which is show a character who is concerned about getting blood on his shoes. And then when he leaves a house, he checks his shoes. Like, boom, we get it. And then I want to read this final exchange between them in the book, which is also what I was saying about Chigurh knowing who he is, like sort of knowing his place in this world. So we have the, you know, he's the setup is basically he's saying, call it with the coin. And she says, no, you don't have to do this. You know, everything you see from the movie. And she says, you can choose not to do this, basically. And then it goes, he shook his head. You're asking that I make myself vulnerable, and that I can never do. I have only one way to live. It doesn't allow for special cases. A coin toss, perhaps, in this case, to small purpose. Most people don't believe that there can be such a person. You see what a problem that must be for them. How to prevail over that which you refuse to acknowledge the existence of. How to prevail over that which you refuse to acknowledge the existence of. Do you understand? When I came into your life was over. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end. This is the end. You can say that things could have turned out differently, that there could have been some other way, but what does that mean? They are not some other way. They are this way. You're asking that I second say the world. Do you see? Yes, she said, sobbing. I do. I truly do. Good, he said. That's good. Then he shot her. It's just like, but when you talk about what the medium can do, the fact that it's written this way, like it's all one line with no quotes, just good. He said, that's good. Then he shot her. So like it is doing something that if the film couldn't do, and the film is doing something that the book couldn't do by using the medium to punch you in the throat with it. That's sort of the intensity of that. I love it.
Yeah. That's so good. It's just like the hard, like the determinism of it also. I always just like, And Chigurh does have a line in the movie that's similar, or that kind of gets at a similar thing of like, you know, if the rule that you live by brought you to this point, what good is that?
Of what use was the rule? Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
We may have already kind of covered this, but can we put a name to what Chigurh is, like what he represents? Like, does he represent a, like just a valuelessness? But he has values yeah, like, I guess, like, Trisha, as the person I imagine has thought about this the most, like, do you have a definitive idea in your head of, like, what he represents in this story, in this movie? Does he represent a certain type of value, or is he, like, the absence of values, or just death, or, yeah, how do you interpret him?
I mean, death is, like, a pretty concise way to put it, right? But mm-hmm. but death as being, I don't know, if you want to call death the great nullifier of meaning, right?
Mm.
Which is that when you arrive at that point, it is often unexpected. It is often not poetic or meaningful or heroic or elegant or in some way linear, right? Like,
right.
It is often not caused by anything you did do or didn't do. Like, there is no way to understand it, its finality and inevitability for all of us. And so all of those things you could also summarize as being chaos, but essentially the chaos that death sort of is and represents. So that's kind of where I see Shakur as existing. And to face off against a force like that is, as Ed Tombell says in his opening monologue, to put one's soul into hazard, right? He talks about, you know, I don't want to push my chips forward and mm-hmm. go out and meet something I don't understand. A man would have to put his soul into hazard, right? So he talks about putting his life into hazard, but as long as there's an orderliness to the way that he lives, he's like, I always knew you'd have to be willing to die to do this job, right? There's an orderliness to that if you're a sheriff, you're a lawman. So like a bad guy might kill you, but you're trying to administer the law. There's a black and a white to that. But to like eventually go out and just meet chaos or something that you absolutely cannot understand, which in this case, I think death is kind of like, yeah, I don't want to call him the Grim Reaper. That's like a dramatic oversimplification, but right. But eventually facing that you're gonna not be here anymore and you won't be able to control how or why. Maybe people will kill you while you're standing on your own front porch, right? Like as in that story Ellis tells about his great uncle Max in 1909. Mm-hmm. It was like, right. Just like, what year is this? I'm sorry, the math on the generations there is quite something. But yeah, I think that's where I land with it, where it's just like Tommy Lee Jones has a way of understanding the world that doesn't include a meaningless death.
Right.
And then that's where Shakur comes in.
Yeah, everything you just said, except I would zoom out further and say that even though obviously Shakur is responsible for a lot of death in this movie, I would say it's not just death, it's sort of inevitability. You know, ironic because Thanos is also in this movie, but but Shakur is inevitable. Like he is in the and he's sort of everything you do, there's a chance. So like the coin, everything you do, there's a chance it's going to go one way or a chance it's going to go another way. So, you know, you may go to volunteer at the soup kitchen, but then while you're away from your home, you didn't catch the fire that burned your house down or something like that. It's not just about like when you do good, good dude. It's not karma. It is sort of, as you were saying, Michael, kind of a deterministic, like this is what life is. So people are going to die. People are going to have bad things happen to them. Every choice you make, there are outcomes that may or may not be the result of that. So I think that it's like, yeah, death is the most pointed and obvious result of that. But I also think it's sort of like if you zoom out a little bit, it is just this sense of inevitability, time, it's all moving forward. Things are going to happen. And all you can do is the little glimmer of hope we get in that final monologue is someone's going to be waiting for you making a fire, hopefully, right? When all this is over, because it will be over. And like that's that.
See, I don't interpret that final monologue as hopeful.
I think he's hopeful, or he's wishful, at least.
It's kind of like a last send up of like maybe at the end of it all, maybe like when you get to heaven, right? Because his dad has died long before he has, and he's like,
right.
I had this feeling he would be there when I got there. So mm-hmm. it's like maybe mm-hmm. heaven, some kind of something after this.
Right, he's carrying the horn to make the fire. Yeah, yeah.
Like, right.
No, but then I woke up.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, I feel like that definitely always plays for me as like he's describing like arriving at heaven and it being okay, and yeah. then he wakes up.
Right, just like that's what I mean by hopeful. It's like I'm not necessarily right. saying the Coen brothers are being hopeful. I'm saying right. Bell is being hopeful, at least sort of like imagining this as the best possible outcome of his own inevitability.
Mm-hmm. To zoom out and maybe go even harder on the nihilism, I feel like the way I feel about this movie is, you know, I think a lot about, you know, the title, right? The No Country for Old mm-hmm. Men. Mm-hmm. And that Chigurh represents just like, yeah, chaos or inevitability, whatever it is, but it doesn't have a moral connotation to me. It's just like, this is existence and you can't fight it and things are going to change.
Right.
And you can think that's good or bad, but it's going to happen. And sometimes change is good. And I think I also can't help but like, you know, the good old days that Ed Tom Bell right. thinks about, like, weren't the good old days for everybody. Like there was
right.
lots of things that were like not great. And like, yeah, just things change. And like, that's okay. So it's like, it's this weird thing where Chigurh is like, he's obviously a scary antagonist person. Yeah. But I'm also kind of like on his side because like... There is no other side to be on except like this is the march forward and chaos and things will change. And even, you know, when Ed Tom talks to that other sheriff and he's like, got kids with green hair and like, what's even, right. why don't you stop saying ma'am and mister, it's all got like, so those are like kind of conservative values that like meant something, but like things change and now green hair doesn't mean you're the devil. Like
right.
things right. change and that's okay. And if part of that is this chaos that sometimes brings misery, well, that's life.
Right. And that's the constant loop is we've all been on either side of that. We've all been the people being like, man, old man, like you don't get it. You don't get what us kids are. And, you know, especially those of us in our sort of 30s going into 40s, like we're also, oh, wait, what's TikTok? Like, what's going on? Like, it is this like endless cycle.
What the hell is happening now?
Yeah. Right. This endless cycle. And that is the old men thing. It's just sort of as you age, the world is changing behind you. And like, but I think there's something beautiful about a movie that just says like, but that's the way it is. So like, let's deal with that.
Yeah.
I literally wrote the note at the end of like, Tommy Lee Jones looks like how Alex feels when he looks at TikTok videos.
I make that same face.
Just really quickly, the title is an allusion to William Butler Yeats's Sailing to Byzantium,
right.
Which is about like aging and outgrowing like optimism or like idealism that you might have when you're younger. I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but it's basically talking about like, whatever is begotten, born and dies, caught in the central music, all neglect monuments of unaging intellect. But basically Yeats is talking about like, yeah, the change, sort of what you guys are saying, the change is inevitable. And that as we get older, we end up all having to succumb to change, like, and of course, like ultimately death, where, like as we get closer and closer to death, we're more and more resistant to like the process that brings us, right? It's like sort of this escalator that you just like want to jump back down the escalator, right? Because as it takes you closer and closer, then there's no more on the other side. So you become more and more resistant to change. And that's kind of everybody. Like, I don't see anybody like wanting things to continue to change faster and faster as they get older and older. I don't know. It's hard to see myself, even myself, wanting that.
Right. Well, and thinking back through the movie, you know, these three main characters, we've got, yeah, Llewellyn, Anton, and Ed, you know, they do represent almost this, you could look at them as like these different kind of like cultural value moments. Like you've got Ed representing the traditional, like, you know, conservative and, you know, maybe more religious and more innocent kind of a moment in American history where it's like, you know, one segment of the population could relax comfortably in kind of safe communities and everybody believes the same thing. Everybody has the same, you know, shared language and values. And there's like this traditional comfort in that, that is slipping away. And then you've got Llewellyn is living in this modern world ruled by money.
Modern in the 1970s, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is a period film, so.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah, modern, not
1980.
Not to 2021, but yeah, it's 1980, where it's like, you know, this Llewellyn is not being driven by traditional kind of old school moral values. He's like, we're gonna get rich, honey, and we're gonna like get away with this money and like, you know,
quit working at Walmart.
Yeah, quit working at Walmart. you know, that's the kind of like, you know, capitalist, you know, we're seeking material resources kind of value system. And then Anton is kind of like this postmodern, like just screwing with the whole thing, just being like, all y'all are screwed, like reality, here's reality to come bite you in the ass. So it's another way to read this film. The more we talk about it, the more ways I'm seeing to read this, and I love it, and it's just so good.
Well, and quickly, just to, you know, highlight what you just said about money and capitalism, obviously this movie is about money pretty fundamentally in a lot of ways. And so, you know, we're talking about sort of these like philosophical ideas about like death and inevitability, but it all exists within this capitalist society and this like struggle for money. And so,
right,
you know, talking about chaos, a lot of what happens is chaos, but it's chaos that's driven by just like a crazed pursuit of a satchel of money. Right. Like if Llewellyn had just walked the hell away,
but it's too much money. Like it's too much money to walk away from. And it's the perfect amount that nobody can walk away from this money.
Right. And I just feel like it's interesting where the money piece keeps being like underscored by different things. And Chigurh is kind of the only person who doesn't care about it, but everybody else is being pushed and pulled by money. And I think the dual scenes where Llewellyn uses money to buy clothes, like to get into Mexico, and how that's echoed in the end where like basically Chigurh also has to like use money to buy clothes from some young men. And they're both like dealing with younger men where they're like, here, give me this, you know, give me your jacket and your beer and I'm going to use that to get to Mexico. I'm wounded, whatever. And those kids that are like a little older, they're like teens. Those are teens that are already poisoned by the like lust for money where he's bleeding and they just are like, let him hold the money, right? Like even though he's like, oh, it's right here, just take it. They're already poisoned by that and they're so, you know, greedy for that money that they're willing to extort this bleeding person. And then the younger kids, Caleb Landry Jones and his buddy, you know, who are dealing with Chigurh at the very end, like at first are like, no, you can just have my shirt. Like you can just have it. But then when he gives him the money, it's like one of the last things that we hear in that scene is like, well, half of that money is mine. Well, it's like, but you still have your shirt. And they're just, they already, those two young boys, they're kids, start fighting over the money. And the Coens just seem really concerned with reminding us about like the fighting over the money is also what hastens like your demise, or just like this, the ugliness of life is just brought about by like people just fighting over money all the time.
It's also a really interesting comparison between Moss and Chigurh at the very beginning. I noticed this first time where we see Chigurh say, hold still, when he kills the man. And then we cut to Moss and he says, hold still before he shoots.
To the deer.
Deer. Lots of, parallels between them throughout that are really interesting. And there's so much to talk about. We could go on and on. I think we're going to pivot to lessons. Before we get into lessons, just a couple things to announce. So we passed 900 patrons already, which is so exciting and really cool. So that means our episode on our top 10 favorite films of the 1990s, 1990 to 1998, will be coming out with a patron exclusive on our top 5 favorite films of 1999. That will be coming down the road. So keep an eye out for that. Also, No Time to Die is out today, which we're all very excited about. So we're going to go watch it this weekend and then have a patron exclusive episode on our thoughts and reactions to No Time to Die coming out next week. So keep an eye out for that. And finally, a reminder that for our $5 and up patrons, we're doing an exclusive series on Foundation, the Apple TV Plus show, where we share our thoughts and reactions week by week to each episode. So very busy. There's a lot going on. Cool. Okay. So lessons. Alex, what's your lesson from No Country for Old Men?
Yeah, every time I watch this movie, it just reminds me, like I mentioned earlier, the pure cinema feeling of this film. And, you know, I'm somebody, you know, talk about Foundation, for example. I'm a sci-fi nerd. I like overly complex world building and scientific mumbo jumbo and, you know, lots of exposition and just all that nonsense. I'm a nerd for that. But it's good to be reminded of what actually draws us into a scene. And often the scene is very simple and it's just a matter of life and death, and the stakes have been established. The characters are complex and interesting and have really strong motivations and desires. And then we just watch that simple problem play out. And it is the most compelling thing you could ever imagine. And it's so just
a coin toss.
A coin toss, right. It's just the right characters with the right context. The simplest possible scene can be the most thrilling, engaging thing ever. It's just a good reminder that the thing that matters is not having a convoluted plot with the most twisty turniness going on. It's about really complex, fascinating characters we love to watch, who have strong desires that are at odds. Put them in a room together, put them in a situation that is intractable, and let it play out. That is really what we're here for. Just a good reminder when I go off into my sci-fi lava land. That's not necessarily what audiences are here for. That can all be fun. But at the end of the day, they're here for that simple scene that is just so good because of those characters and the situation and the desires.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah,
it's a great lesson. Trisha, what's your lesson?
Yeah, mine's actually kind of related to that, just in that this is a really good example of a movie that you should watch if you are, for some reason, wary of putting theme in your story. No need.
It's for eighth grade book reports.
To be fair, there are eighth grade book reports that are better than some of like the end of Game of Thrones. Anyway,
this is what I'm saying. We talked about how this movie opens with a monologue about the theme, about the passing of time, about how you feel lost when things are changing, about the inevitability that that will be the case for you, and how death and violence will come to all of us at some point. Like, that's what the opening monologue is about. It's beautifully delivered by Tommy Lee Jones over those incredible, like, dawn, like, landscapes and those, yeah, so good. But it starts us there. So we're already thinking about those themes as the movie starts off. We know what to be on the lookout for. They're signposting for us. Like, hey, this movie is about aging and Westerns and the themes that Westerns deal with and how things change and da, da, da. And like, it, here's the character you're going to end up with also. Like, even though we're going to introduce you to these, like, the central protagonist and the antagonist along the way, and Tommy Lee Jones is going to kind of seem like he's just sort of out there on the periphery, not really influencing events, just kind of trying to process and make sense of them. That's where we're going to end up. Right? It sets us off on a thematic trajectory, which it never varies from. Every scene is kind of about those things, or at least we can read them through that lens because we have been prepared to think about them through the lens of the theme. Thank God. Like, it is one of the best examples I could think of to point to and say, this is why theme should be in the DNA of your script. It's why it should be in the DNA of your film. You need to know what the hell it's about. Not necessarily before you start writing, but definitely before you start shooting. Like, if you find it in the writing process, great and fine. But it should be in every frame of the movie, or it could be. Like, that's an opportunity that you have. And it doesn't have to be flattened or simplified. We just spent more than an hour pretty much unpacking the different themes that are in this movie. And we didn't even come close to scratching the surface of every single place that those themes can be found.
Sure.
Because they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. They're in the set design. They're in every moment of every performance. They're in the sound design. They're in the lack of music and just the sound of like blowing wind over the prairie. The theme is absolutely everywhere in every speck of this film. And we are, as the audience, are prepped to engage it when you tell us that that's what you're doing. That's what this movie is. And that's why the final four scenes of this movie break your heart so completely, because we are ready for them. They're not just random. They're not caused, but they are specific and connected. They're with characters that we care about, but they're not the scenes that we expect. And yet they still feel of the theme. And so we are ready to have ourselves like stretched and broken by the conclusion of this movie. I could go on. But anyway, please do a theme, for the love of God, in your screenplays.
All Trisha wants, just have a goddamn theme.
It shows that theme can be in the DNA of a movie about anything. Even a dinosaur.
Exactly. Exactly. We have a video about that. You can watch that too.
Yeah, those are Alex's lesson, your lesson, Trisha, like, are just nice, like, simple back to basics, like, have a scene that matters and is compelling, and then have a theme so that scene has meaning, and right. you will have a great story. Good work, everybody.
That's a movie. You did right. it.
It's yeah. as simple and as hard as that.
Yes, yeah. exactly.
So true.
Brian, what's your lesson?
I mean, based on both those things, mine is less simple, but supporting all of that, which is this idea of the filmmaker gods, which I know I mentioned
yeah.
earlier in this episode and I mentioned in previous episodes, but I felt like this would be a good time to sort of like actually wrap my brain around what I mean when I say that. And when I started thinking about this, I was like, just for starters, people seem to forget that things happen in a movie because the filmmakers made them happen that way, right? Like, people seem to think that like a movie could only be one way and that's just how it is. So, and of course, some movies are based on books where the original author, but whatever, like the storyteller, whoever said this thing is happening, they said it for a reason. You know, they know the easy and satisfying choice is for Rocky to win, or for Frodo to confidently drop the ring into Mount Doom, or for the Joker to have an origin story. They know that is the easy and satisfying thing that audiences are going to expect. So when they do something else, it's usually for a reason. We may not like the reason, we may not agree with it, but there's this sense that it's bad writing because the good guy lost, or it's bad writing because it's like, if you don't understand why it happened, or if you do understand it and you don't like it, those are two different things. You can get into it, go listen to our Last of Us Part 2 episode. But yeah, it's like as if it never occurred to the storytellers that like they could have done it a different way, right? So of course, when it's well done, it's done for a thematic reason, or at least a plot reason. At least it was like, well, this thing had to happen so that this necessary plot thing could happen. So that's just the start of like, things happen for a reason. It's not a coincidence that like movies have scenes that you maybe didn't expect or that happen in a different way. But then what comes from there is how that filmmaker, that storyteller chooses to do that thing. So a simple version, which I mentioned before, you know, a character who's narcissistic is walking down the street, checking himself out in the window, gets hit by a bus because he was looking at his own reflection, right? So a very clear, like your flaw caused your own punishment. Like that is just sort of a nice and neat karma kind of thing. But then you have what I call the filmmaker gods, where the filmmaker steps in and says, well, we kind of need to intervene here. The term Deus Ex Machina literally means God from the machine. It comes from ancient Greek theater, where during a play, the gods would very literally show up and do something because like it wasn't happening, or the protagonist couldn't do it, or something couldn't happen. So the storytellers had to say, well, we have to sort of intervene now and do this thing. Like, you want to see this character punished, so we are going to punish them for you. So even if like the good guy didn't get the bad guy will still get got.
Right.
And then you have No Country for Old Men, where you have that so frustrating car crash scene where you kind of think like, oh, okay, now the filmmaker gods are going to come in and they are going to save the day, because if, you know, this is all inevitable, then this character of Chigurh should be prone to it too, right? He can get hit randomly by a car just like anybody else can have. But no, because the character is this inevitability. He is this death, this chaos, this whatever. So he is unstoppable. So, you know, the reason that it happens is because of the theme. It's because of what they're trying to say. That's the whole point, right? Is that like they are continually saying, you want the good guy to win. Sorry, he's dead. You want the bad guy to get punished. Nope, sorry, he walks away. You want the other good guy. You want the movie to end on not just a dream. You know what I mean? Like it is doing all this stuff for all these thematic reasons. It's doing it so beautifully, but it's the idea that it's playing with that sort of filmmaker God thing. But the very simple lesson is just remember that you can be that person. Like anything you tell in your story is your way of saying right. like that. That's a very simple way of putting theme. Like whatever you are doing in your story is how you are saying the thing that you want to say. So what are you trying to say? And then go make your story do that thing. So if you want to say this thing about greed, then show characters being greedy and getting punished for it. You know, like it's that easy. You can be very complicated and go No Country and do all sorts of meta on it. But there's a very simple way of doing it, too.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like, yeah, like the choices of the filmmaker gods are the theme. Like,
exactly.
Those choices are what theme are.
Exactly.
Do a theme.
Yes, do a theme. And as you're pointing out, Brian, it's like No Country does it next level, because
right.
it's the form of like the medium is the message. Like it's right. doing the thing to put you. That's why it just like.
It knows your expectations. It knows what like Westerns are supposed
to be. It breaks your expectations.
Yeah. Right. It does it on all the levels and then adds another level on top and then does it again. It's super good.
But it doesn't break your expectations just to break expectations. Hashtag Game of Thrones.
Hashtag a lot of things, yeah. right?
Right. right.
Yeah. If you want to mess with the rules, you need to know why they're there. And you need to break them in very specific ways. Don't just break them in any old which way. Got to break right. them very specifically.
That's why you need to know your theme.
Yep.
Wow. It all comes back, doesn't it?
It all comes back. Yeah, I have kind of like two like mini lessons because I forgot my first lesson until just now and I still like it, so I'm going to say it. But I really like smart protagonists that make choices that I can yes. get on board with.
Yes, yes.
And I feel like Moss is just 100% that. Like, I am not yes. that human being at all, but I'm completely with him in every choice he makes. And I'm like, oh yeah, no, that does
Big
make sense.
Time.
You are smart to think of that. Or like, okay, cool. So I buy into him. Get Out is the other one I think about a lot, which we have mm-hmm. to talk about at some point. We're like, I love Get Out because I'm with the protagonist. I'm like, yeah, you should be worried. I'm glad you are raising these concerns. You're not just like a dumb person that's like wandering through this situation ignorant so that the filmmaker gods can pretend like there's a plot happening. You have a smart protagonist that's making rational choices. And yet the antagonist is so well designed in this that it's not enough. And so I just love that. That's just another thing this movie does so well is like, I'm completely on board with the protagonist and their journey, but also the struggle is designed to be exactly the most hard thing for that character, despite his intelligence and cleverness and all that stuff.
I mean, this is a hallmark of the genre, but I really love all the scenes where we just get to watch characters like do very small tasks that are like building up to a plan that's uh-huh. like really smart. So like, we're just like watching Moss cut hangers apart and like tie them to the rod from the closet. And we don't know why, but it's like these little things where it's like, he's gonna go buy a bunch of tent poles. Okay. And they build up to like, what is a really smart plan ultimately. And so I wanted to say this earlier, but it's just one of the many examples of how this movie trusts us as the audience to yeah. be intelligent yes. and to follow what's happening and put together without spelling it out in dialogue or like really hammering it in the filmmaking. It's like, we're just gonna watch a character do a bunch of small little things and put it together ourselves. It just gives us so much dignity as the audience. Mm-hmm. I really, it's so refreshing to watch a movie like this.
It feels yeah. good. Yeah.
It's a smart movie.
It respects the audience. It doesn't condescend, but it also doesn't like try to trick us or like right. lie. And like, it's telling you, but it's telling you in a way that lets you be a part of the telling.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of plugs in a little bit too. I was also thinking this time, sort of for the first time, because usually I'm caught up in all the other amazingness that's going on, but just the basic idea of perspective and what perspective you play a scene from. And it's interesting that sometimes we're really with Chigurh and other times we're really with Moss. And the two examples that jumped out at me are once Chigurh has figured out which hotel the money is in, right? Which hotel room for the first time. And you see him do his little routine where he checks into the other hotel and I'm going to open the door and like, okay, get a lay of the land. And you see mm-hmm. him, then he takes his socks off. You watch him do that whole thing. And it's fascinating to see how he works. Like telling that sequence from the perspective of him is really compelling and stressful in its own way. And then later, there is the scene where we see that whole thing from Moss's perspective, where he's checked into a hotel and he like hears a noise and calls on the phone and the guy downstairs isn't there. And you see the chat like,
mm-hmm. so good.
And so it's doing different perspectives. And it's also using the fact that it did the earlier perspective to inform the other. Like, it's just so good.
Yes.
Two plus two.
Yeah.
Dude, that scene is so long where they're in the Hotel Eagle, which is actually the midpoint where they first meet for the Clash, first time. Yeah.
As much as any of the three protagonists meet in this movie.
Right.
That's why that is like the midpoint, right? Where it's an actual confrontation, the only one in the whole movie, basically. But the scene where it's like the buildup to Chigurh is coming is so long. Mm-hmm. It's minutes and minutes that drag by where like, Moss is like looking for the trans transponder transmitter thing. He finally finds it. He realizes, and then like he calls down to the desk and no one's there. And then the light goes out in the hallway and he's just sitting and staring at the door and the shots just go ticking by for like seconds. There's no music. God, it's so good.
And you know what's going on the other side of the door because, again, of what they've...
Well, you know the lock is going to come flying right at him.
Right.
It's so terrifying.
Yeah. It's great. Yep. So those are some lessons from No Country for Old Men. We could keep going and find near endless numbers of them, but we will not. We will talk about what you guys have been watching recently. Trisha, what have you been watching recently?
So I decided to catch up on a cinematic landmark that was a hole in my filmography.
White Chicks?
How did you know? No, I watched Scarface for the first time.
Wow.
The Al Pacino Scarface?
1983, yeah. Yep. Brian De Palma and Al Pacino. I had not ever seen it. And it is 3 hours long.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I didn't know that.
You haven't seen it either?
No. What happens for 3 hours in that movie?
I haven't seen it either.
There's a lot of Tiger. There's a lot of 80s music. There's a lot
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Al Pacino just doing a whole thing. I'm so sorry. It is pretty early on. I'm going to spoil a pretty early on scene. There's a whole scene with a chainsaw that I just didn't need in my life. Like, no. Look, I've seen a lot of De Palma movies. I haven't seen them all, but I got to be getting close. And this was pretty a lot, even for De Palma.
This is pretty a lot.
Anyway, there's a reason this movie is iconic. There's a lot of iconic moments. Michelle Pfeiffer rules in it. Yeah. Like, I wish I had her haircut. I wish I had her whole thing in it. If you could get her whole thing without doing a lot of coke somehow. And it's just like, it just has so much going, you know, just that has that epic scope to it. It just feels like really big at every moment. Like even from the first couple minutes of the movie, you're like, damn, I'm getting into like a whole big thing. I'm excited that when we hit the 1,000 patron mark, we're going to talk about The Godfather. Because I feel like the conversations you could have about Scarface, you could have about The Godfather, but like more so. But anyway, Scarface, very glad I finally checked it off my list. Sometime, Brian, you're going to have to do one of your Al Pacino impressions from this movie.
Oh my God. the impression of the impression. I feel like the only quotes I can think of, I can't say on this podcast. So I'll
I know. I was going to do a few myself and then I was like, I absolutely cannot. But yeah, if you haven't seen it, I'm not going to say it's worth it, but I am sort of glad I went ahead and did the whole thing. It probably took me several weeks like to watch it. Like,
to get through it?
I was watching it in like 20-minute intervals. Uh-huh. I didn't have any more in me at like one time, but I did get through it. Anyway, Scarface, 1983, Brian De Palma. I don't know what to tell you if you're not here yet.
Yeah.
You could skip it or, you know, you could just finally go ahead and just, you know.
Screenplay by Oliver Stone.
Yeah, Oliver Stone, oh, you know what? It's a really good example of inevitability, you know? Mm. Sort of like in the theme of No Country for Old Men, you know, Scarface comes for us all.
It's a fascinating movie because I feel like it's like the best bad movie in the sense that...
Yes, that's a really good example.
That like most people who watch it nowadays are like, this isn't a good movie. But when you look at every single critical, it's like lauded and top movies of all time kind of lists. And so it's like everybody loves it, but also everybody like acknowledges that it's not good, which is really interesting.
It's just like so big. Like every scene of it is so big and Al Pacino is just chewing the scenery. And you're just like, okay, like did the room need to look like that? There are so many mirrors. The shag carpet is so deep. There's an enormous mountain of cocaine. Like you have so many guns. I think that there were hundreds of bullets, like thousands of bullets fired. I don't know. I'm sorry. I've got to spoil another thing. There's a scene where somebody gets hung from a helicopter.
Yeah.
And I'm like, a balcony would have done, a chair would have done the trick. Like you did it from a helicopter. This is a really good example of what Scarface is.
I mean, that's kind of crazy in a cool way, but
again,
it's like an R-rated Fast and Furious kind of a setup. Sounds like
right, yeah. But it's taking itself deadly seriously. Uh-huh. The other thing. Anyway.
Awesome. Okay. Scarface. Great. Brian, what have you been watching?
I've done my one of my watchings that a little out of order, so I'm going to Tarantino it now and do an origin story of why I've been watching some older movies like Truffaut and Brief Encounter, which is a couple months ago, I went to a screening of La Dolce Vita, the Fellini film. And
love that movie.
I had seen a couple Fellini over the years, but it'd been a while. I didn't really remember it. So I watched La Dolce Vita and I was like, this is really fascinating and interesting and challenging. And I gotta watch some more to figure this out. So then I spent the next few days watching I Vitelloni, La Strada, Knights of Cabiria, and 8½. So I just went through like a whole, like the top five Fellinis. And it was really fascinating to watch from with a modern lens, because the recurring theme is of all of his movies is like despicable men and the women who have to deal with them, basically. And I was reading up, and Fellini's basically been both praised for satirizing like machismo and, you know, what we would now call toxic masculinity, but also criticized for being like, but maybe you didn't do it the best, like, you know, like you tried and your heart was in the right place, but that's kind of ugly. And so it was interesting watching the first two, La Dolce Vita and I Vitelloni, which have male protagonists, where I'm going, am I supposed to be rooting for these guys? Because they're like sympathetic dicks. And like, I'm not quite sure what's going on here. But then going into La Strada and Knights of Cabiria, where Giulietta Messina, who was married to Fellini, she plays the lead in both. And she gives these two completely different performances. And they're both excellent. And that's where I started to go, okay, I'm definitely not supposed to be rooting for the men. Like, they may be empathetic and that's fine, but like, that's not who I'm supposed to be rooting for. Now I have a better understanding of what he's trying to do here. And all of that was the perfect setup to then go into 8½, which is just the perfect culmination of everything. Cause you have this male protagonist and like the movie is completely about women and his relationship to women, but like going in with that sort of foreknowledge of having watched the other films, I was like, okay, cool. Instead of being like really bonkers and like off-putting, this makes so much sense and it's insane and so much fun to watch. So yeah, it's like, I really appreciate what you're doing here. And you're just, you know, it's sort of like a Coen Brothers thing where it's someone who is just having a lot of fun with the filmmaking and sort of is like, we can just go into a dream sequence for 20 minutes. Cause like, that's what this movie is. That's what we're doing. Go have fun. It's a dream sequence, you know, strap in. So yeah, go watch some Fellini. I would recommend watching it roughly in that order, you know, hit me up. I can give you some recommendations, but like, it was just the perfect thing to watch it in that order where I felt like 8½ was a movie I'd seen before, but didn't quite get. And then now it was like this perfect payoff to like, I had the vocabulary to appreciate it.
Very nice.
Awesome. Cool.
Love a classic film recommendation.
Yeah. As always, our Twitter handles are in the show notes, so you can hit Brian up there and get all the recommendations. What I've been watching, I've mentioned before on the show, but there's a new season of Fox Explained on Netflix.
Ooh.
And I've realized that it is one of my favorite shows of all time. Which is maybe a weird thing to say, because
that's
like
a very Michael thing to say.
I was going to say, incredibly on brand.
Yeah.
Video essays, the show.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're like, yeah, these 20-minute documentary explainer things, but like no other show consistently, like literally makes me cry. Like this show for some reason, and I've been trying to unpack that and figure out why. And I have a kind of thesis, but so, if you don't know it, it's these like 20 to 30 minute episodes on Netflix where it just explains a topic. And it does so in a way that to me feels objective, very non-judgmental, tries to kind of quickly show you all the different sides of an issue. And some of them are serious issues. Some of them are fun issues. So for example, this season, one episode was about sugar and the health ramifications of eating too much sugar. What parts of all of that is false? What was kind of constructed to put down fake sugar things and make you think that like fake sugar causes cancer? Like it kind of clears the air of all of that. Talks about royalty flags. Why are flags so important and meaningful? Dogs. There's an episode about dogs narrated by Jake Gyllenhaal that like ultimately is just about like dogs can essentially feel love and are best friends and like gets into the science of it.
It proves they love us.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the list of narrators right now and it's insane. Ethan Hawke, Samira Wiley, Rainn Wilson.
Yeah. Yeah. Carrie Russell.
John Waters, J.K. Simmons. Yeah.
Yeah. So like each episode has a different narrator. Great. Yeah. End of oil chest, like your skin, apologies. What is a good apology? Hurricanes, plastic surgery, dance crazes. Anyway, they cover all this like really wide range of topics. But I feel like what it does to kind of throw back a little bit, when Obama was running for president, there was a lot of speeches about like hope, right? And I feel like what happened was I heard speeches about America and what it could be. And like, I suddenly found myself getting emotional because it made me remember that I deeply cared about our country and people and what we could be. And it like reawakened this like love that had been buried under the cynicism of like, you know, George Bush years and all that stuff. And I feel like this Vox series does the same thing with me, but like for humanity as a whole. Like hearing, like watching an episode about like dance and just like, yeah, we are like meant to dance and be together, and it expresses something, and it's something that like connects us, and it, I don't know, it pierces through all of my cynicism that I've built up over many years, and it just like reminds me that I care about humanity. So it's like, it makes me remember that I'm invested in the world, and also is like educating me about important things that are useful to like have in your head as you're going through life. So Vox Explained season 3, thumbs up from Michael.
Wow. So if you too are a robot, you could watch this and try to remember maybe that you are human deep inside.
Or if you're, yeah, struggling with cynicism and objective facts about how, like, some things in the world are good help you, this is a great series for
you. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense from what I know about you, Michael. Yeah, it's like, this is a scientific, like, undisputable, like, laying out of facts that there is good in the world.
This is why dancing is good.
Yeah, right. Like, you can't deny this.
The science of dancing, the science of dogs.
I didn't enjoy dancing until I understood it.
It's like, yeah, it's a really nice like reminder of like, oh, right, dancing is a thing that I don't think about, but I love dancing. Dancing is great. Like, there are good things in the world. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It is a great series. I love it as well.
Alex, what have you been watching?
So I'm going to recommend to our listeners, if you are like me and you love the composer Max Richter.
I do.
Yeah, he's so wonderful. His music is just, it just hits this sweet, sweet spot for me of like bittersweet, melancholy gorgeousness. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple movies on Mubi, which I'd recommend you check out. It could be a nice Max Richter double feature. Be very trippy, sleepy, wandery double feature.
Okay.
But these are both movies that I really loved. So one of them is called Max Richter's Sleep, which is a music documentary about this really ambitious, crazy thing Max Richter did for, I guess, a few years. He toured, he came to LA, was one of the places he came, with this 8-hour like symphony, basically, that was meant to be listened to while you were drifting in and out of sleep. To basically put you like kind of catch your brain in that like hypnagogic state between waking and sleeping and dreaming. And it's meant to be like just getting into your soul in this other way that you wouldn't let in while fully awake and attentive and trying to like focus on music. In this documentary, they like both are covering the kind of backstory of Max Richter, who he is, his family, his life, why he does what he does, mixed in with this kind of, it's like a concert film about them staging this crazy thing in downtown LA where they like took over Grand Park. I think it was Grand Park, and had cots all over the park and just invited people to come lay down in the park.
I think I remember this when it happened.
Yeah. Like it happened just a few years ago and people just like were given blankets and cots and just said, just come lay here and we're going to play music all night and like let it, you can just soak it in. And so it's a really cool, interesting, beautiful music documentary. And then you can follow that up with an equally strange, interesting movie called The Congress, starring Robin Rice. Really trippy movie that has one of the most gorgeous Max Richter scores, in which Robin Wright plays herself as an aging actress with a son who has like a disability, who is looking for a way to like, you know, kind of get back her career. It's a really fun like meta movie where like she's going to like a Paramount style lot and they have like posters of her from The Princess Bride and her agent saying, like, you know, you could have been the biggest star in the world, but you, like, you kept turning down these offers and you wanted to only play these interesting roles. Anyway, it's this weird, like, self-referential meta movie that then becomes a crazy animated, like, trip, because the idea of the movie is that they digitize her. They're like, you don't have to act anymore. We're going to digitize your body and, like, soul, and we'll just own your, we'll own the IP of Robin Wright. And then she's with John Hamm and a bunch of other actors, like, in a crazy, like, anime digital worlds, and it just becomes like a fever dream.
Wow.
And it's got an amazing Max Richter score. So that is my trippy, sleepy, wandery, moopy double feature for you. Max Richter's Sleep and The Congress. You will feel weird and you will feel sad.
I think I feel high just listening to you talk about it, actually.
This is definitely one of my what is Alex watching generated things. Like, it's just like, insert actor here. John Hamm, sure.
Yeah. Robin Wright. Great. Yeah. Anyway, that is my recommendation. And they are both currently on Mubi.
Awesome. Well, yes, if you haven't picked it up, this episode is sponsored by Mubi, which I'm really happy about because they were one of our earliest sponsors and kind of helped get the podcast off the ground. So always welcome to have Mubi here. If you haven't heard of them, Mubi is the curated streaming service featuring exceptional films from all around the world. These are the kind of films you can find on Mubi. They have a lot of different things. They have art house stuff. They also have some mainstream things. There's a very eclectic collection of films. If you want to have a chance in hell of knowing like what Trish has watched or what Alex has watched, apparently, for what we're watching, Mubi is great for that. And if you want 30 days of Mubi for free, you just sign up at mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. By heading to that link, you are supporting our show and also getting a month of great cinema for free. So win-win. You have a double trippy feature waiting for you. I kind of want to do, is the 8-hour thing available? Like, can I play it?
I think on Spotify there is the full sleep concert. And like, I think it is meant to be like, you just play it on a speaker by your bed and let it soak into your soul overnight, which I should do.
Maybe I'll do that tonight. We'll see. Yeah. But yes, thank you to Mubi for sponsoring this episode. Again, sign up at mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. This has been our second conversation about No Country for Old Men. If you are a brave patron who has listened to the original episode that we recorded on my iPhone, let us know if we covered the same things, but I don't think so.
I feel like we definitely could not
have. We did a lot of 2+2 in that and not a lot here. So hopefully, yeah.
Yeah. Now this was like a whole new thing, which is great. This was really fun. Again, thank you to all of our listeners for being with us for 100 episodes. It's insane. We're so, so grateful for each and every one of you. Thank you to the patrons, as always, for making this show possible. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major, and our editor, Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. As I mentioned, all of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi. Thank you again, and we will see you in the next episode for...
Well, we're just going to start at number one again now, right? So, like, Shaun of the Dead, Devil Wears Prada, we'll get the Searching guys back. Yeah, we've got 100 good movies. We'll just talk about them forever.
It's like Dark.
Yeah.
There is no beginning or ending.
We're going to make Trisha watch Dark again.
Oh, good.
Oh no.
We will see you next episode for Psycho, the 1960, you know, the Psycho.
Yeah.
We should also do the Anne Heche and what's his
Vince
name?
Vaughn.
Vince Vaughn.
Vince Vaughn. Yeah.
The Gus Van Sant shot for shot remake.
There you go. Some of us will watch that one. Some of us will watch the original and we'll compare notes. We'll see you next time.
We love you. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is why we need an Eric to clean up all of that.
Yeah.
He will.